HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Opinion.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Peter Kim, and I am the executive director of the Museum of Food and Drink. We are a nonprofit that is launching the world's first large-scale food museum here in New York City. A food museum. Now, what would be in a food museum? So imagine a place where you could use an Aztec kitchen, watch cereal made before your eyes, decode food marketing strategies, see how the body digests a sandwich step by step, learn about agriculture, and trace the economics of chocolate from bean to bar. And, of course, discuss important issues like the future of meat. Now, we are all incredibly passionate about this project. 2.5 years ago, I had a respectable job as an attorney, relatively high paying, and I quit to work on this museum at a time when we had no money, no plan, no team. At the time, also, Emma juggling several grueling jobs in order to be able to work on MOFAD. This is a project that is near and dear to all of us. So, of course, we have all these volunteers who are donating time on top of their busy schedules, and we're very grateful for that. But we've come a long way, but we need your support. And so I ask everybody here to please consider becoming a sustaining member of the Museum of Food and Drink. I can tell you quite sincerely that every contribution will have a palpable effect on what we're doing, and it would mean an enormous amount to us. So please go to donate.mofad.org and become a member of the Museum of Food and Drink. Help us create this museum, because it's about time we have a food museum here in New York. So at this point, and again, donate.mofad.org. At this point, I want to introduce my dear friend and colleague, Emma Bost, the program director for the Museum of Food and Drink, and she's going to kick things off. So please join me in giving her a warm round of applause.
Hi, everyone. Thank you, Peter. So thank you all for coming. We're thrilled at the turnout for this event, and I'm really glad to see you all here. This is MOFAD Roundtable. If you're not familiar with this program, it's an ongoing series of debates on current and controversial food issues. We've tackled GMOs, the New York City soda portion size regulation, and most recently, the ethics of marketing big food. Today, of course, we're talking about meat, and particularly the present and possible future directions of meat consumption and production, particularly in this country, but elsewhere as well. A really quick intro for our panel. Their bios are in your program, so I won't delve into those. We have Peter Singer of Princeton University, Patrick Martins, who is the founder of Heritage Foods USA, Isha Datar, the executive director of New Harvest, Mark Budolfsson, also of Princeton University, and Dave Arnold, the founder of the Museum of Food and Drink, who will be moderating our discussion today. Just so you know, in your programs, there's a small survey, and we'd really appreciate it at the end of this event. You could just take a moment to fill that out. It's very short, and we'll have volunteers at the door there to collect those. It's really important to us that we know what you thought of the event, and it helps us determine the direction of future programming. Also, a big thank you to the Manny Cantor Center for hosting us in this lovely space, and also to Heritage Radio Network. They're here actually recording audio of the debate, which will be posted on their website at heritageradionetwork.org. They're a nonprofit food-focused radio station, also a great cause to support. So without further ado, I'm going to let Dave give a brief tertiary intro and talk to the panelists, and then we'll get started. Thank you.
Hi, thanks. Thank you. Thanks for coming. So for those of you that haven't been to one of these roundtables before, the rules are quite simple. We're going to start at one end and work down. Everyone's going to get 2 minutes to kind of give you their spiel, their pitch, kind of why they're here, the general views. Then I'll pitch a question to each one of them, and everyone else will have a chance to respond to that question, and we'll allow some give and take and some conversation, but no talking over each other and, you know, no huge grandstanding, and remain polite, otherwise we'll have to bring the hammer down. But it hasn't happened so far. It's actually been a lot of fun. And then after each of you get a question pitched to you, we will have a closing two-minute statement, and then we'll get questions from the audience. Okay? So why don't we start down at this end, Peter Singer.
Thank you. So
We're here to talk about the future of meat. I suppose I could say I hope it doesn't have a future, but that's not quite right. Oh, I got some support there anyway. That's not quite right because we're going to hear from Isher about the possibility of growing meat in the lab, and I certainly have no objection to lab-grown meat if people want to eat it and if it's environmentally sustainable from the form of production. That's not a problem because the two major concerns I have about meat is that it involves inflicting suffering on animals and that it's environmentally damaging to produce it the way we do. I think it's pretty obvious that animal agriculture, as it's practiced in this country and indeed anywhere in the world, more or less, where there's developed countries, is a long, continuous nightmare for animals who are confined indoors in extremely crowded conditions, in conditions that do not at all suit their instincts, which they still have, and that they are just cogs in a very large machine for productive purposes. Many years ago, Ruth Harrison wrote the first book about factory farming called Animal Machines. She said, "Cruelty is acknowledged only where profitability ceases." In other words, you do everything that you can to get more meat, eggs, milk out of the animal as cheaply as possible, and it's only if the animal stops producing that you acknowledge a limit. Unfortunately, animals will continue to produce when it's clear that they're having miserable lives. Just as we, for example, might gain weight even though we're not happy. So if you feed animals high-intensive food and you don't allow them to exercise, they're going to gain weight. So there's the cruelty perspective, but there's also the environmental perspective, which is becoming more important as we realize how damaging global warming is already and is going to become. And you're probably going to hear, perhaps from my friend Patrick on my right, that meat can be sustainable if it's reared outdoors. But unfortunately, as far as ruminant animals are concerned, that's cattle and sheep in particular, putting them on grass does not reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. In fact, surprisingly, it increases it. It increases it because they have to do more digesting per pound of meat that they put on. So it's no solution to say, I only eat grass-fed beef. As far as the climate is concerned, you're increasing the damage you're doing by doing that.
Oh, shit. No, I am with a real hero of mine. My mom bought me my first terrier dog when I was like 10. His name was Pepper. He was a Dandy Dinmont Terrier, and I thought about everything that he thought about. And I was always worried about him, and is he happy? And it drove me to buy Peter's book, and I really look up to you. And although I did write a book called The Carnivore's Manifesto, I actually consider it maybe one of the greatest vegetarian manifestos of all time, because I 100% could not agree more that if an animal suffers at all during the rearing process, that should not be eaten. And I, too, call for a total boycott. A slow turning of the wheel, but, I'll explain to you my business. I started an organization in the U.S. called Slow Food USA back in 1998. And one of the slow food projects was the Ark of Taste. And onto that ark, they boarded endangered foods and drinks, including livestock. So I met the preeminent poultry breeder of rare breed endangered turkeys in the U.S., Frank Reese. And he said, listen, the Ark is great, but I actually need to sell some of these birds. So Slow Food was like, we are not going to risk getting into sales of meats. So you have to start your own company. So Heritage Foods USA was started. And for 2 years, it was the marketing arm of Slow Food. And all the profits went to Slow Food. And because all of our animals are naturally mating, we raised about 2,000 of these rare breed turkeys. They're all naturally mating. So all the farmers only had one day of income a year when we would send them the turkey check, because turkeys have sex in the winter, they're born in the spring, and they're ready to eat in the winter. So a lot of those farmers were like, could you please help us and buy other foods from us so that we can get a sustainable source of income year round. Pigs have sex all the time. Chickens have sex all the time. So we got into pigs, actually. I work on the genetics. You know, one of the biggest cruelties of corporate farming is that they overbreed the animals too much for fast growth and whatever they're looking for profits. In the case of turkeys, it's white breast meat. So these animals actually arrive to the slaughterhouse already injured and in pain because they grow way faster than their cardiovascular and, respiratory systems can keep up. So we only sell pure breeds. I sell 200 pure breed pasture-raised pigs a week, about 10,000 turkeys a year come Thanksgiving, ducks, geese, and goats. And, my big thing is that meat should cost a lot more. And I think it's actually classist and maybe bordering on racist to say that meat should be cheap and that expensive meat is wrong. Meat should cost a lot more. We sell ground beef for $18 a pound on our website, and it should probably cost more. People should eat less of it, but they should eat the best. And I have more to say, but that's a little bit what I do.
Hi, I'm Isha Datar. I'm the executive director of New Harvest, which is a nonprofit organization which is trying to advance technologies that allow us to sustainably and affordably feed a growing population. And I think we're most famously known for advancing cultured meat, which is, of course, meat produced through cell culture rather than through raising whole animals. And we've really identified animal agriculture, especially industrial animal agriculture, as one of really the worst things in food production today. And we think that further innovations in animal agriculture right now at what these large industries are looking at tend to still keep the animal there. So any efficiencies you gain in terms of growing more animals or growing those animals faster come with a lot of costs. And those costs tend to be animal welfare costs. They tend to be costs to the environment. And they also tend to be costs to public health to us. We use majority of our antibiotics in North America for livestock, and livestock are really a source for all kinds of diseases, not only antibiotic-related, antibiotic-resistant, bacterial, foodborne illness-type diseases, but also epidemic viruses. So what we think is if we just remove the animal from the picture, when most of the time when people are eating meat, they're really just eating, you know, a collection of tissues. A chicken breast is boneless, skinless, has very little to no resemblance to where it came from. If all we want is these tissues, why not grow from the smallest living unit, which is the cell, up, rather than the most complex organism, which is a beautiful chicken, only to cut away all those things that really make it a chicken. So it's really important that we are a nonprofit because I think that food production is really something that is in the public and should be about people. And so as a nonprofit, we really incorporate the voice of many people who are involved. Thank you.
So I'm Mark Rudolphson. I'm a philosopher. And like Peter, I'm interested in issues of effective altruism. So for example, suppose you care about animal welfare. The question is, what can you do as a single individual to best make things better along the dimension of animal welfare? So should you be a vegetarian, for example? That's what Peter thinks. I disagree with Peter because I think that your choices as an individual consumer can't be expected to make any significant difference for the number of animals that are produced and harmed. You as a single individual consumer in this enormous supply chain. So I think that what's most effective to do if you care about animal welfare is to focus on changing the public policies that really need to be changed to solve this problem in a bigger way. And a sort of related worry I have about in the effect of altruism area is if as ethicists we tell people that what they should do to solve the world's problems is vote with their dollars by consumption choices, if people think that that's all that's ethically required of them, they won't support the sort of public policy changes that we really need. So, for example, in connection with climate change, a lot of people think that by changing light bulbs in their house or buying a Prius, they're doing their part to solve this problem. But if progressivists like us all think that way, we're not going to invest enough in the sort of public policy change that we really need to really make a transformative change of these problems. So another sort of thing I think about a lot in connection in the food domain is animal welfare is not the only thing we should care about. We should also care about human welfare. For example, think of all the migrant workers who pick the berries and fruit that we consume. Because they're doused with pesticides day in and day out, their bodies are broken over a decade or so if they work in the fields that long. There's a surprisingly high harm footprint for lots of vegan staples, too. So how does that complicate questions about what you should do as an individual consumer? And more generally, how should we make trade-offs between these competing values when thinking about issues in the food domain?
All right, I'll send the first question over to Peter Singer. It seems at the core of animal liberation, your book is not really an argument about sustainability, right? And the sustainability is something you're bringing up now because a lot of people are very interested in it, but really at core is an ethical argument about us not taking the suffering of animals seriously, right? And my question to you is on an ethical basis for eating meat in the book, why do you feel it is that so many of us meat eaters can hear the ethical argument and maybe even not have the ability to refute it on a philosophical basis, but yet still don't follow the conclusions that are drawn from the book? How is that happening? How do you see that happening?
You know, we're not entirely ethical beings, and this is one example, and perhaps it's a particularly pervasive example because most of us have grown up with a habit of eating meat, and habits are hard to change. Habits particularly that are reinforced by social conformity are even harder to change, and even though there are far more vegetarians and vegans now than there were 30 years ago, still for most people they're living in societies that are meat-eating, and they would have to make this change, and implicitly they would have to say to relatives and friends that I now think the way you're eating is wrong. So I think people are quite reluctant to do that, and I think that's one of the things that makes it hard for them to make that change, even if they accept the ethical arguments. You know, it's not the only case where people can see an ethical argument but don't act in accordance with it, unfortunately. So it's a particularly common example, but it's one of a phenomenon that we're fairly familiar with.
Patrick, you want to weigh in? We usually go down the line. Do you want to weigh in on that? What you think of the ethics of meat? Is there an ethical dilemma for you in eating meat?
I mean, I was reread Peter's book. I mean, I did agree with I would never eat my dog, you know, Red. I mean, I might eat West, who would be very succulent, but I would never eat Red. And I think the ethics is gastronomy, culture, butchers, salumi makers, ham curers, I kind of grew up with that kind of cultural connection. I completely agree, with eating them, and I know that that's wrong. I mean, you can't really say, I believe in everything Peter says, but I'm okay with eating them. But, the way we raise our animals, I am. I mean, we buy all of our, we buy 100% of what our farmers raise. They're all pasture raised. And it comes down to that final minute. There was always that final minute. They get taken to the slaughterhouse. How is that? How is that? How is that? And, I'm able to answer that for myself. But I do also feel somewhat inconsistent because, I'm talking about their rights, but I'm prepared to kill them. Then there's also the whole argument of, their job is, Red's job is to be a pet, but the pig's job is kind of to be an animal and to be eaten. And Temple Grandin said if you didn't eat cows, they would just be funny-looking animals in zoos. And, it is kind of inconsistent, and yet I kind of am okay with that final act as long as they're treated humanely and have been given a good life, and as long as that slaughterhouse is certified by groups like Certified Humane or Animal Welfare Institute. And then there's also the group like Heifer International. Animals are given to communities and they become a big part of it, and to survive the winter they might eat that animal. So There's a lot. There's all these histories behind it that make me kind of okay with it. But yes, in the end, I suppose it is somewhat inconsistent to love animals but be ready to kill them.
Okay. Isha, what do you think?
I think anyone who knows about meat eating and is a meat eater, there is some level of willful ignorance there where you know it's bad, and that's why you don't like watching those animal cruelty videos and stuff like that. No, you know, no one likes watching that, because then you have to change your behavior as a result of it. And I think there's also, because the buying meat and purchasing meat, and there's so little transparency in how that happens, it's very easy for us to convince ourselves that the meat that we're buying is somehow better than meat you would normally buy. So maybe after eating or watching one of those videos, you eat less McDonald's, but you buy meat from some store where you can believe that it came from a better place. Of course, you don't really know that for sure, but you can kind of create these worlds where you're on a sliding scale towards a better situation. But I think it's total willful ignorance.
I think another part of the story, maybe not a very interesting part, is that there's just not good vegan options available every time I'm ready to eat. So I think if there was amazing vegan food just right in front of me all the time, maybe I'd eat vegan almost all the time. Right. So I think that's part of the story too. And that's an opportunity for entrepreneurs to come in and make that better. And not necessarily entrepreneurs. What if McDonald's had, like people often say, wouldn't it be great if there was a really good vegan burger? You know, they could probably make that taste exactly the same as the cheeseburger. Mm-hmm. And then that would be available everywhere all the time, more or less.
Well, see, I wonder where I want to go with that. Maybe I'll go with the vegan cheeseburger or any form of ersatz meat, let's say. So, you know, Isha, you're interested in kind of creating not meat analogs, but actual kind of meat that's grown. Mm-hmm. And my question, and it's often pitched to you, and you say, well, it's like, you know, it's like computers were back in the day, or like right. the internet, that, you know, yes, it costs $300,000 to make a hamburger now, right. but, you know, maybe it'll be $3 later. Right. My question isn't that focusing kind of on the wrong thing, because it would be much more technically feasible, better to just create something that meat eaters like to eat as much as meat that's not meat, something that gave you the feeling you got from eating meat that wasn't actually a cell. Wouldn't that always be more efficient if efficiency is, in fact, your argument?
Oh, I'm sure there's a lot of different efficient ways to create a meat analog or create versus the exact same meat just produced in a different way. And I think the approach that we should have is not choosing which one is best, but embracing kind of a portfolio approach, because the more different options we have on the table, that means you have more vegan options to choose from that aren't meat. I mean, people eat meat for different reasons. So maybe you want the version of meat that's more environmentally friendly, or you want the version of meat that it has a higher protein content, or you want the version of meat that is as accurate as a different kind of meat. So I think I don't think we should think about it as which analog or which alternative should we focus all our energies into. I think it's more about creating a different ecosystem where meat means many different things.
I guess my quick follow-up, my question, I didn't phrase it properly. Isn't it fundamentally a hatred of food to reduce eating meat to something that can be grown from a culture? I guess, is kind of what I meant.
Well, is cheese a hatred of milk?
Well, I don't see that as analogous, actually. I don't see that as an analogous.
Right.
But anyway, I'm not here to give you my opinions. I'm just asking, like, in other words, like reducing meat, which is a complex, you know, fats, muscles, proteins, collagen, grown, fed different things, different flavors. Is it reductive? Is that actually anti-food? Is what I mean to say. Not my opinion.
I don't think it has to be viewed as reductive. I think when we normally think food science, we think it's, you know, reductive and come down to this level of just producing something that we can mass produce. But cultured meat doesn't have to be that way. And also the idea of multiplying a cell twice is not particularly, you know, many, many times, is not particularly novel. So there's this opportunity to kind of create a culture around people culturing meat in different ways and making it kind of a disrupted thing where many people are doing it in different ways. So think about cheese. I know it's not really technically similar, but there's so many different kinds of cheeses. You can make them at home. There's so many different kinds of yogurts. There's so many different kinds of beers. Those are all kind of biotech products in a sense. There could similarly be so many different kinds of cultured meats.
I mean, there's a little bit, I said, you know, savoir-faire, you know, the hand of the maker. I invented this word called terroir, which is French for head. It's the terroir of the mind passed down from one creative to another. Mm-hmm. You know, also the question is not only about, you know, is it anti-food and is it anti, like I say, this charming's inconsistencies when you can truly see the handmade, but also a bit maybe biodiversity on the ground, you know, different breeds of pigs actually in the farms, in the fields, and that's also part of the culture that might get removed, you know, if everything is raised in the test tube. But I don't know, I had that written down, so I thought I would say it. Terroir.
But I think the question also really shows a false sense of priorities. I mean, if we're in a situation where something like 9 billion animals are being produced in the United States alone in horrific conditions, and all of those sentient beings, or, you know, nearly all of those sentient beings, will put aside the few hundred that Patrick produces, if you like.
Thousand.
A few thousand, good, good. But still, and 9 billion, it's not a big factor. If they're all living horrific lives to produce meat that people want to buy, and if in addition the livestock industry makes a major contribution, bigger than the entire transport sector, to global warming, then to worry about is this anti-food or pro-food or whatever, if you're trying to do something that is really going to change the situation, eliminate all that suffering, eliminate that contribution to climate change, seems to me to be really not a serious worry. You know, I'd be prepared to say if it does all that and you want to call it anti-food, who cares? Let's do it.
Well, I also want to say that, Patrick, it's a compliment that you would think that lab meat would displace everything, because I don't know if it would. I think it actually would displace the really bad stuff and make more room for the stuff that you're kind of working on.
I was just thinking, imagine the best burger you've ever seen, and imagine that could be more easily duplicated anywhere in the country, anytime, by some specially tailored meat product, artificial meat. I think there'd be a market for that. The best, juiciest, most perfect consistency burger in all those ways.
But what makes it artificial if the cell comes from that juicy animal, I suppose?
Well, unnatural in people's intuitive reaction, but I don't think that would stop them from eating it is all I was thinking.
In gem parlance, synthetic, right? Not artificial, synthetic would be nicer, yeah. But, okay, so Patrick, I'm kind of surprised to not hear you to come out kind of just, you know, I eat meat because I've heard you say it many times. Like, I eat meat. I don't feel bad about it. To take the position of the farmers that you represent at Heritage Foods, isn't this more of an urban problem? People that don't grow up with kind of the life and death cycle of animals as part of their daily life, like the feeling conflicted about it, mm-hmm. right, is that really just an urban problem?
You mean whereas farmers would have no issue in supporting the seasons and seeing the holistic farm and eating the pig that they grew up with kind of thing,
right.
It's easier for them?
And as a pre-thing, I'll just say also that I doubt that you, Peter Singer, would be okay even with that type of farming. Although you have the big hammer that factory farming is a real problem, I doubt you'd even be okay with that kind of farming.
You know, I mean, I think it's good that animals have good lives. It's obviously much better. I'm actually a little skeptical about Patrick's claim that, you know, everything is great until the last minute, because let me ask you, for example, do you castrate the male pigs, or do your farmers castrate the male pigs?
Yes, they do.
Do they use an anesthetic when they do it?
I believe so. Yes.
I believe they don't. I've never seen it done with an anesthetic. It costs too much to get out the vet, and they squeal. You know, it really hurts them. You try having your balls cut off without an anesthetic.
Well, I've been circumcised. I've been circumcised, and you know, everyone experiences
something.
Yeah, I think you cried
too. Yes. I'm sure I cried too, but, you know.
Well, I mean, you know, one of our farms, Craig Good, lives in the prairie grass region. And, you know, he's actually a big believer in what Wes Jackson believes, that all agriculture hurts the land and that we should only be eating prairie grass. So one of our farmers, for instance, grass feeds his pigs and beef mainly on prairie grass because he believes that, you know, that's the earth's natural grasses, and it's kind of like the earth's salad bar. And you don't really want to rip down prairie grass for agriculture. There's a thin layer of topsoil that's, you know, feeding everybody, whereas the roots of prairie grass run very deep. They're very resistant to drought and climate change, and that is part of his program, free-ranged animals with their hoofs aerating the soil, and that's why he farms. So, yes, he sees actually the eating of his animals as a continuation of nature before agriculture came. So, anyway, that's one example. Prairie grass. Wes Jackson calls for the stopping of all agriculture. And, you know, he would disagree with you saying that we should be, you know, turning farmland for animals into agriculture. He would say that that's bad and that agriculture hurts and that one day the earth will stop feeding us. It's just a matter of time.
If we stop agriculture and try and live just from animals grazing on prairie grass, we certainly won't be able to feed ourselves. It's not that efficient.
You sure, Mark?
I think I'm on the same page as Peter here, although farmers who do take good care of their animals, even if it involves occasional painful procedures, don't the animals still have, they could still have excellent lives well worth living with protection from predators? I don't think it's as obvious if the trade-off is just that there have to be some procedures done to them periodically.
And they could still have lives that on balance are good. Yes, I agree.
And, you know, Frank Rees looks at them as a species, not as individuals. And he says there are more turkeys living, good turkeys living in the world because of me. So individually they might die, although he's very happy to say that his breeders die of old age. And he's also very proud that all of his animals are having sex on the farm. So, you know, they are naturally mating. And so maybe the price for sex and a great life is ultimate death. But, you know, at least they're getting laid, you know. All our animals are naturally mating.
And in fact, the audience probably doesn't know that the standard turkey you buy in an American supermarket is not the result of sex. It's been artificially inseminated because they've been bred to such a way that the males actually cannot mate with the females. So that's a good conversation topic for anybody you know when Thanksgiving comes around.
Well, I'm just thinking, if we're thinking along that spectrum, I guess the best way to get meat would be hunted, I suppose, because it's the most, you know, the least interference with us. But I just don't see how it can feed the population that we've agreed to have.
Well, do you think we're actually already in a position where we're having a trouble feeding the population without production, or is it still a matter of distribution, and we're not even hit the production wall yet?
I think it's both. It's also what we're choosing to produce. We choose to produce more feed for animals than we do food for ourselves.
Don't we waste enough food to feed everyone right now?
I'm not sure if we do.
If you include as waste the amount of grains and soybeans that we feed to animals get back only a small fraction of the food value of the grains we put in, then undoubtedly we do, yes. I mean, we produce enough grains and soybeans to feed the world. But we're feeding the majority of that to animals and getting back. So with cattle, we get back maybe 10% of the food value. With the pigs you're producing, if they're grain-fed, we get back maybe a quarter or something like that, yeah. I think. I'm not sure.
Yeah, we're raising over 60 billion animals per year to serve 7 billion people, and those are over 60 billion animals that don't ever go hungry. So.
Mark, I had a question for you. In your writings, you get this impression that you shouldn't make an individual decision because your utility to eat meat might actually be higher than the amount of a dent you could put in the factory system, right? So it's kind of a why bother shining your candle against the floodlights of factory farming. It seems to me to be the essence of the argument. But isn't that a bit odd to not do what you think is right just because you don't think you can make a difference?
Well, I think what you described is why I don't think that the utilitarian explanation works for why you have strong reasons not to eat meat, because I think you can't expect to benefit any animals, but yet you still get some pleasure from eating the meat. So if all you care about is the expected impact on pleasure, you don't have strong reasons not to eat the meat. But you might think you have strong reasons not to eat meat from a non-utilitarian ethical source, like some sort of what if everyone did this sort of reasoning. Or what I think is that when you think about the good of a steak, for example, it's relatively essential to the production of that good that an animal had to be killed before its natural life was out. And that sort of essentiality of harm lying behind the product is what, in my view, grounds the strong reasons you have not to consume it. And so I think this also gives us insight into, more generally, how to draw the right distinctions between goods like a can of corn at the supermarket that has a surprisingly high harm footprint that lies behind it because of all the oil that is needed to transport it around and run the factories and whatnot. But despite all that harm in the background, there's nothing particularly essential to this good that sort of harm has to lie behind it. And so I don't think that you have especially strong reasons not to consume that. But I want to draw a distinction with other goods where it really is pretty essential to this thing that something bad must be going on in the background. And I put meat in that category. And because of that, I think you still have strong reasons not to consume it just from this different source that's not utilitarianism.
You want to answer, especially with regards to the point about the corn also being a highly damaging product, or many other things also having many, many harms and large bad footprints.
I mean, it's really hard to track the footprint of everything. I guess I actually believe in the idea of a light shining in the floodlight of factory farming, and I think that cultured meat is actually a little bit of a brighter candle or whatever analogy you want to use. So that's why I think it's a good idea.
I just want to add that Mark said canned corn, right, because there's more processing and production of the can, and I think that's part of the problem. And if you're just worried about corn production as such, then certainly avoiding industrially produced meat is a good way to lessen the amount of corn that you're consuming. Michael Pollan makes this point well in The Omnivore's Dilemma. Mm-hmm. In fact, when you go and eat a McDonald's hamburger, you're really eating vast amounts of corn that have been fed to that steer mm-hmm. in a feedlot, which hasn't made good use of them to turn it into a bit of meat.
Anything, Patrick?
Listen, everyone should be eating pasture-raised heritage meats. That's my point. That's it. Because I think, academics can talk. I mean, in the real world, you shouldn't eat fast food, and you should be eating, pasture-raised rare breed meats, Berkshire, Kobe, 100% Angus. I mean, these are parts of the cycles of agriculture. There's huge histories behind them. And, no one should be eating factory farm meat. And if it's heritage breed meat that's expensive, then it's the right thing to do, and that's how you change it. You play the game. And all I do day in and day out is call chefs. We sell 200 chefs in 10 cities, and we ship to them 52 weeks a year, whatever they need. We have a mail order catalog that sells about 70 breeds of livestock. And we're about promoting biodiversity on the ground. So philosophically, I think, we need to be promoting the right type of chicken wing on Super Bowl weekend. And, that's what I'm trying to do. But, many people have followed. And Paul Willis, Nyman Ranch, he did it. I mean, these are big people helping to change the world. So, lab meat and, vegetarianism, I mean, those are about, even Wes Jackson saying that we shouldn't use agriculture at all. I mean, those are kind of fringe things, and sometimes I believe that we forget that sometimes we just have to walk 8 blocks out of our way to go to the proper butcher shop, and then all the answers are right there, and it's a lot easier than we think. But that didn't answer the question at all. But
so we're gonna do the. I'm sure there's gonna be a lot of questions. So we're gonna do the closing in the reverse order. So we'll start with you, Mark.
I don't know if I have any particularly great closing statements other than I think what we've been discussing helps bring out that there's lots of competing values at play in the food domain, and it's difficult to think through how to trade them off against each other. And also an additional dimension is, you know, what effect will actions and investments of various kind actually have in promoting one or other of these goals?
I guess in closing, I think the food system is broken in many places, and I think that by producing meat in different ways or redefining what meat is by exploring different alternatives is a really big way to solve a lot of the problems in which the food system is broken. So I think it's a way to provide a meat that is more ethical and hopefully more affordable and easier for people to, hopefully less than 8 blocks away.
Yeah, that would be nice. We are trying to open more stores. I have the $140 turkey. That's what a turkey should cost, $140. That comes to about $10 a pound. The hell with local, eat the best. If it doesn't taste better, and, you know, that's the vegetarians have a big issue, vegans have a big issue. If it doesn't taste as good, it's all gone. And by the way, Dave and I celebrated how delicious Brooke Headley's vegetarian burger is because it's unusual. He was a real visionary and a miracle worker to make a burger that's so friggin' delicious. But until it was, stop the arguments.
Yeah,
you know,
you're gonna call me in. I don't consider it, like, it's not a hamburger substitute. It's just a delicious
product
that he makes.
It's just a delicious burger, really. You know, survival of the fattest, you know, it should be survival of the fittest. And yes, you should always seek out quality and steep yourself in the centuries worth of terroir that's been built, especially when it comes to meat, because the other side is very dark. And like I said, I couldn't agree more with Peter on every other aspect until the actual killing, which I know sounds crazy.
Okay, but let me then end on a conciliatory note, Patrick, because I think if we limited turkey consumption to those that cost $140 per turkey, and if we did the same with the pigs that you're producing, we would have solved, you know, from my point of view, 99% of the ethical problems that we have with factory farming today and with contributions to greenhouse as well. I still do think that there are other objections even to the remaining 1%, but probably politically, and, you know, Mark in a way is right here too, the politically realistic option is to try to get people away from industrial agriculture. And I think where I disagree with Mark is I think that by setting examples, you actually help to spread the message, and that's why I think that's important. It is not just an individual, I've got clean hands sort of act. But I became a vegetarian because back in 1970, I sat down for lunch at Oxford College, where I was a graduate student, with somebody who refused to eat the spaghetti because the sauce had meat in it, and I asked him what his problem was with meat. So I think, you know, each one of us can set a personal example in that way and can be part of the change that I think pretty much everybody in this panel really agrees needs to be made.
Mm-hmm. Questions? Take questions from the audience.
I'm Ralph Luglisi, former communications director for the Pew Commission on Industrial Farm Animal Production, so I know a little bit about what you guys are talking about. But one thing that I didn't hear a lot of talking about, and there's some interesting concepts, Nicolette Hahn Nyman, the wife of Bill Nyman, Nyman Ranch, just wrote a book, and I was fortunate enough to read it. It's going to be coming out, In Defense of Beef. And she really went into detail about something that you had mentioned, Dr. Singer, was that even free-range cattle will produce more greenhouse gases. One thing that isn't taken into account into all of these discussions is the amount of carbon sequestration from the animals going, walking on the ground, creating these plains, and then it's literally almost zero-sum gain. Even the FAO is saying that they do believe that is something that they didn't put into their calculations, and that if all animals were out there, and that's something that Alan Savory from the Savory Institute talks about, that if we have all of these animals out roaming, we'll bring back the soil, we'll suck back all the carbon into the ground with all the plants. So these are important issues to talk about. Do you guys know, Patrick or Dr. Singer, do you know much about that? And that just really the importance of losing animals, and if we stop eating them, they won't be there. I think that's a big slow food thing. They'll go away if you don't eat them.
Well, I do know a little bit about those claims, but it depends what the alternatives are, right? If we don't have those animals, it doesn't mean that there's not necessarily going to be grassland. It doesn't mean you're going to plow up all of the land for agriculture, because, in fact, we don't need that much land if we're growing plants rather than if we're feeding the plants to the animals or having the animals on grass. So you can still have prairie grasslands, and you can have prairie grasslands with whatever wild creatures choose to inhabit that, and you have more land to do that. It's a complicated question trying to calculate this, I agree, but there are a whole range of things. There's do you count the respiration of carbon dioxide from the animals is another question, not just the methane they produce. There are a variety of different studies, and I'm relying on studies that I could cite you in scientific journals, which do claim that there is a very major contribution to greenhouse gases from cattle on grass. So I think it's a difficult question to settle here without looking at those studies in detail.
I am here as a senior. I was invited to be in this meeting. I would like to ask several questions, not only one or two or three or four. Are we eliminating the meat completely? This is what I heard or I understood. In nature, it is one like we go to the wood and we kill each other. They kill each other to eat. We have to eat. I am with how to raise the animals. Even I am half, three-quarter vegetarian, I don't eat. One of the things I change my mind not to eat a lot of meat, it is I watch one movie, Foods That Inc. And that's what changed my mind to eat any kind of meat, especially the cattle. It's not good, or the chicken. They put them in very, very small area, and they raise it without even enough time to be complete to kill it and eat it. So what is this idea of we don't have any meat anymore? We eliminate it completely. Where is we shouldn't eat eggs, or we shouldn't eat cheese because it's the product of animals and we don't want to have it, what the Mr. Singer or Dr. Singer said, all the turkey, they are raised, not sex or whatever. So what is all about? We don't have to eat meat because of what? Sympathy for the animals or we eliminate it completely? Where are the animals going to go? The nature goes for one killing each other, and because we have the brain to kill them, but we have to be human to raise them the right way. So please answer all these questions.
So,
I don't know.
So is the deal? Is the main focus of your question, like, what the heck? Animals kill each other anyway,
yes.
So why can't we kill the animals? Why have all the sympathy for
no,
the animals where people were different?
At the beginning, we said there is no meat anymore. So what we gonna eat? Only vegetables? And what? Where are the animals going to go? Where are the animals going to go? Raise them right. Nature has to go, and we are human. We are the killers, actually. We are the human being. Raise them and kill them, or we don't kill them.
All right, so finally, someone in the debate who's coming out and saying she doesn't feel bad about the animals getting killed. What do you think of that?
Yes.
Okay. So, so in short, yes, I would like to see a world in which we didn't eat meat, and we don't need to eat meat. I haven't eaten meat for 40 years or something now. I think that is the better option. If you ask about the other animal products, unfortunately, to produce dairy products, you have to make cows pregnant every year, and then you have to take their calf away from them. And if you know anything about the bond between cows and their calves, that's very distressing for both of them. So there are problems there. With eggs, you know, I think you could argue that if you're going to eat animal products, eggs from truly free-range hens out on grass, living a reasonable life, might be the best that you can do. But I think we certainly ought to be trying to go as far as we can in avoiding the commercial production of animals, because it really seems to always involve significant amounts of suffering apart from the environmental problems.
But I don't think you're biting on the apple here, which is, I'm a person, it's okay for me to have an animal suffer because I am a different category person who has the right to kill an animal and do with, I mean, like, this is the old school argument. So then you're not really, I don't feel the full force of, you know, I've read it, your attack on why it's not okay for us as people to say animal suffering is other and lesser and less important.
Well, I mean, it's very dangerous to say this is other, not me, and therefore its suffering doesn't matter. You know, we're familiar with that, not between species, but between races. It's very easy to say they're the other in a different sense. My view is that if it's a sentient being, if it's a conscious being that can enjoy life or feel pain and suffer, then its interests come into, ought to be taken into account. We can't just ignore it and say, I enjoy eating it, why not?
Well, also, if we're the killers, how many of us have killed an animal here in the audience? I mean, I don't think many people kill their own animal. I mean, I'm sure many do. And I guess if you're hunting or something, I guess you could argue that that's the best raised meat possible. But I just don't see that many people doing it, so it's a little bit hard to
Doesn't that response go back to the earlier question I actually had for Patrick? Isn't this an urban argument, an argument where we grow up with styropacked meat, and therefore, you know, but that's strictly speaking just an argument that would have arisen over the past 50 or so years and only in urban environments, right? I mean, it's not really at the core of why it's bad to kill. It's just you're saying we're not used to it, and we would be squeamish, right?
Yeah.
But they're for it. I mean, that's where we sell 60,000 pounds of meat a week, every week, except for the holidays, where we might do 300,000-400,000 pounds. And 80-90% of those are going to cities. So I think it's an urban issue to ask the questions and find a better solution. And it's ironic that a lot of the farmers who live in places like Kansas are eating fast food all the time, even though they're raising the greatest meats in the world. So I think that issue about these urban people that feel uncomfortable with the killing is actually translated to launching a sustainable alternative, or, you know, sustainable to me, or one that treats the animals better.
And Mark, I didn't mean to cut you off before.
So one thing is, I'm worried about the idea that hunting is the best way of harvesting meat, because as someone who grew up in a very mad about hunting everything family, animals really suffer in the course of hunting. They're often shot, and then they struggle, and you have to track them for hours while they are terrified and blood's coming out of their nose and that sort of thing. So that, compared to a relatively quick death on the factory farm, I would, as an animal, prefer the quick death. Another thing, just to go back to the basic, like, why should we care about animals at all? Suppose you think that God gave us dominion over animals, or you think that animals, maybe you don't have the religious story, but you think animals are just a lower life form than us. So then you might think that animals don't have anything like a right to life and stringent rights like we have. But still, I think we would all agree that, like, the suffering of an animal is still something bad. For example, suppose there was a pig here and I, as some sort of philosophical demonstration, started pounding nails into its back, right? No one would think that that was okay. You'd probably jump up and intervene because you think that the suffering of the animal matters and that I had no good reason to inflict that suffering. But isn't that really, in some sense, exactly the same thing that's going on with factory farmed pork? The only pleasure that matters that we're getting out of it is the taste, and the same sort of intense suffering is being inflicted on the pigs involved if you study the relevant facts carefully.
Question. Hi. This is a question for Isha. So I'm a vegetarian, but my other half loves meat, and so I recognize that some people just have strong cravings for meat, and it's hard for them to give up. So I'm very excited about New Harvest. And I wanted to ask you, Isha, what is, I know obviously there's a lot of research going on and there's uncertainty because it's novel research, but like, what would you say the ballpark is for when we might expect a commercial burger to be available?
That's the big question. I think that really depends on how many people want to get into this research. Right now, there's fewer groups than I think a lot of people think. There's only really a couple of groups that are advancing this, and it's a struggle. I think when it comes to cultured meat, we get so much media about it. We hear so much about it in the news, and there's a lot of talk about, you know, they are working on it. But there really isn't a very big they. It's this interesting situation where there are more people studying, like, the social impact of cultured meat than the people actually advancing it. So it's, you know, it's advancing at a really strange pace, which is maybe the way responsible science happens these days, or it's something, a new trend, I don't know. But what really will depend is how many more people get into advancing cultured meat. And I think, well, I'll throw out someone else's number. Mark Post, who made the burger last August, he says 7 years until something. So that's his number. I'm not sure what the number is. It really depends.
So I think maybe all people who would like to be vegetarian but find it hard, maybe they should be donating, right?
Yes, exactly.
And by the way, have you tasted any of these things?
I've tasted a cultured meat product, but it was not really designed to be like a meat experience, a traditional meat experience.
Hi. So I want to show this banner because I want to talk about this. And it says, all animals want to live. Make the connection. On this banner, we have humans. We have a little baby. We have an older person. And then we have animals in between because we all want to live. And I feel like, and I like this discussion and I appreciate it, but I feel like we're not talking enough about that all animals want to live. So we're talking, Mr. Martins, you're talking about, you know, they're having sex and they're reproducing and it's good quality, but there's no acknowledgement of they want to live just like you, just like me. They want to live.
Well, I mean, there have been times where I don't want to live.
They all have.
Do they want to live?
I want to live.
I mean, I don't think a pig wants to live. I think it is.
They
happy.
Want to live. Their physiology proves it. They have the same nervous system that we have. They have the same. They have feelings, and we know that. They squeal out in pain when you hurt them. So I feel like we should. This is something that we should talk about. We should share their stories. What are the stories of the animals? We talk about, oh, you know, if they have a good life and, you know, they got to have sex and whatever it is that they do, and then there's this 1 minute, which I'm really sure it's a lot longer than 1 minute. But would you talk about me like that? Would we say, well, hey, we gave you a nice life and we're going to kill you really quickly? No, because I want to live. So I want to know where. Let's talk about their stories.
Well, if a pig let's talk comes about up their and stories. Asks me a question, I'll answer.
There's this pig over here, and his name could have been Charlie. It could have been whatever you want to call him, but he never really got a chance to even have a name. Do you know why? Because pigs usually get slaughtered at age of 6 months. I don't know what's the age of yours, but it really doesn't matter because after all, they're being murdered. And this pig is just like my dog, Reza. He laughs.
Now,
he has parents,
ma'am, like,
brothers, siblings.
It's the question. Okay, good.
Just one quick question. If you had to live the lives that these animals live, if from the day that you were born until the day of your death, someone had planned your entire existence, would you really be happy? Would you let him live, please? Would you let him live?
Yes, I mean. Well, what were you going to say, Dave?
Well, no, I was going to. Well, I'll let
now
you.
Now the debate is going. I mean, listen, the pig is not asking that question. I don't think it understands. When I go to the slaughterhouse, all the pigs are asleep outside. They don't know what's happening. They're very happy.
When they're about to get killed, what do you see their faces? Do they look? Can they sense that they're going to die?
No, but I also know that, like, for instance, the red wattled pig is a breed of pig that goes back about 500 years and was on the brink of extinction and actually was once thought to be extinct. And so, yes, while sometimes there's pangs of doubt when I see 50 of them about to be slaughtered, I know that collectively as a species, they are doing better because of me personally. I mean, we sell 90% of the red wattle pigs.
Wouldn't it be better by killing them? Wouldn't it be better to just let them live? Because they want to live. You want to live, and they want to live.
I'm trying to...
Hold on, guys.
Are you
guys
together?
Guys, first of all, hold, people, guys, you're grandstanding in a panel that has Peter Singer on it. Let's just be clear on what you're doing. Like,
Peter,
so,
Peter, we love you and we appreciate but
doesn't necessarily...
no one's talking about letting the animals live.
It's...
If I had to choose,
sir, have you read? Have you read the actual documentation on crustacean nociception? Lobsters, saying lobsters want. What does it mean to want to live? Like, yeah. Are we going to get into a philosophical discussion here of what future?
You said
what
that philosophically knowledge? We should have a good chicken wing. You said philosophy. Yeah, we have the right to sit here and talk about killing them. So why do they not have the right to live?
Listen. I think you're in the wrong. I think you think that you're in a livestock breeders association here. We're like trying to have a discussion with like most people who are on your side. What do you think is happening here?
Also, no one is promoting that here on this panel.
Yeah. What is it?
Promoting death.
What is it you think? I'm what? Peter Singer's promoting death? Wait, is it? Do
you
think Peter Singer's promoting death?
Not you, Peter.
You think Isha's promoting death? So all of this is just against Patrick?
No, it's not all
this is just
him. We want to talk about their stories, and it's not being mentioned. So we're talking about a commodity. And you, sir, you sat here talking about the best burger and everything. You're not talking about them like an individual.
First of all, I eat meat. Second of all, my job here is to elicit responses from our panel in a reasoned discussion, not a discussion about a lobster that you've given a name to or what is probably awful cattle prodding situations. It's to have an actual discussion, not just holding up a picture and chanting slogans about a particular pig that may or may not. I mean, this is a picture of a pig. You didn't go to a farm. That pig is in grass. That is like a pastoral. That is like freaking Babe the Pig. You're giving me a picture of here.
This is not a product.
This is just a load of nonsense.
This is an individual.
Can we have a reasoned argument with
individual?
I would like to say, if you were...
We approach this very peacefully, sir, and you're getting very combative with us. You're getting very combative. We just want
to
tell their stories.
If you were born...
Here's what I
would...
I don't want to be combative. Please ask a question of our panelists.
I'd say... If you were to die and come back as a pig, you would want to be a pig in my farming system for sure. So take what you
can
get.
No, I wouldn't. I'd want to just be a pig and live and do what I want. I wouldn't want to
be. But by the way, you would be in the zoo.
As a meal.
So the question is,
its only purpose is food, not pets.
Do pigs just want to live? That's the question. I'll take it to the panel.
And we don't want to be combative. We really just wanted to bring this discussion to the table.
We
are thinking of ourselves, a human being. The nature telling you we are animals. We are animals, actually. We are mammals.
Okay.
So why we have the right to kill and not...
There's a question to the panel. Let the panel answer it.
All right. Peter?
Okay. Look, I think you've made your point, and I think you've done it very well, and everybody in the audience is aware of what you're saying. So, thank you. I think it's reasonable to let everybody have a chance at asking a question, and you know, I think you've made that point. I think there are questions about what kind of cognitive abilities do you need to have to make sense that you want to live. I mean, there is a physiological sense in which you could say, these beings have evolved so that they survive and reproduce. But that's not the same as a conscious desire to go on living. Now, maybe a pig does have a conscious desire to go on living. It's perfectly possible that pigs have sufficient awareness of themselves existing over time. I think that may be. And perhaps with the cow you've got there, I have to say I'm more skeptical about the lobster, that it, you know, because a lobster doesn't have the same kind of brain, and I don't know of any evidence about
it. They don't go into shock the way that we do, so their pain is actually
more they're suffering.
Intense.
Look, absolutely.
Way more intense.
I mean, but I think we're all agreeing with you. Where we're talking about suffering, I mean, I think to throw lobsters alive into boiling water is totally disgusting. I think it's clear that they, well, it's not absolutely clear, but it's highly probable that they can feel pain and that they do pain. And the Dan cow, totally, I think. But I think we're agreed with that. On the question of simply the desire to live as such, I think it probably does depend on the kind of being that you're talking about. And it may well be, as I say, with the mammals that we eat, perhaps with chickens as well even, that they have some sense of wanting to live. It's hard to say. But for me, also, I have to add, what is really clear is that they have the capacity for suffering. Mm-hmm. And because that is pervasive in commercial animal raising, that's enough for me.
And I mean, I just said, I mean, we live in a culture, the U.S., I think, processed 11 billion livestock for food last year alone. So when you consider that, me and my company is the solution. I mean, you are looking at a solution to the problems of suffering. And it might hurt you guys to hear that, but, you know, every vegetarian should be supporting companies like mine, because you know, they are not trying to change the trajectory of the planet, but we are allowing the animals to live decently while they're alive, and that's not something you can save for most of the livestock, yeah, until their death. But collectively as a species, they're doing a lot better because of groups like us.
I think all life wants to live. I mean, sunflowers turn towards the sun. I'm not saying we should worry about plants' rights or anything now, but what I'm saying is that everything wants to live. And so if we can produce food without having to kill something, I don't know why we wouldn't do it.
Yeah, I think I agree with what everyone else has said so far.
All right.
I'm a vegan and an animal rights activist. I don't have a sign. I want to talk about economics. My impression has been that when you have a system that has a lot of economic externalities, it is not long for this world. Eventually, it will buckle. And we're seeing that with agribusiness and global warming, that all of the environmental damage has been an externality that the producers of meat have not been paying. So now I'm wondering, and I suppose this is directed at Patrick again, by charging $140 for a turkey, you are paying for some of those externalities, but you aren't paying for that one moment of slaughter and for the years of life that turkey doesn't get to have.
But so it wouldn't have been alive in the first place. It would literally be a zoo animal. There would be 100 of them in all the world. And
but,
that is important
but
to
we
say.
But we don't live in that counterfactual reality. We live in this reality where you're killing turkeys. So isn't
but they're
that
being bred
those
for
years
us.
Of life that they don't get to live, why isn't that an externality? Thanks.
I mean, their job is to be food. I mean, it's what Temple Grandin said. I mean, it's boring to keep repeating the same thing, but the pig's only job in this world is to be food. That's it. And
you said the point of the living longer, though, Patrick. You're saying that turkeys are interchangeable.
Say again?
You're saying that the turkeys themselves are interchangeable. As long as there is life of turkey, it doesn't matter which individual turkeys. I mean, is that your point? That
well, I'm
this
raising,
individual
I'm
turkey
raising
could have
endangered
lived longer?
Breeds.
Isn't your point that this turkey could have lived longer, and so it's not okay to just raise another turkey instead of it?
Yeah,
that they're not interchangeable?
These jobs are to be food. I don't think everything in the world exists in relation to the human species. Turkeys exist to be turkeys. Yeah, they don't have a job.
Yes. But they wouldn't the red wattle pig is its own species. It does well. It's being grown because there is demand for it. And so the breeders live forever. But again, they would literally be 500 pigs in America, and now there are all these millions. I think as a species, it's doing very well. I mean, there's a relation with mankind.
I'd rather not exist. Thank you.
May I just interject for 1 second here? Hi, Peter again. I'm voted with MoFad. And
I just want to remind everybody that the spirit of this event is really to take, for us to all listen to a full range of opinions on controversial issues. Obviously, meat is a very controversial issue, and rightfully so. And, you know, I hope that everybody can see and respect the fact that we as an organization have made a good faith effort to bring in the whole range of perspectives, you know. And so for those of you who strongly disagree with Patrick or with, you know, say, Peter Singer, I mean, I hope you can see that we have tried to bring other opinions into the discussion as well. And so the only thing I ask, and, you know, I want everybody to feel very open about the questions that they ask here, as long as it doesn't turn into too much personal grandstanding. But please, you know, we're starting to get to a point where I think somebody's saying something and everybody's sort of shouting from the audience. And, you know, I hope you can see that that might not be the most productive way to further the discussion. So all I ask is just, you know, let's go forward with the questions, please, but try to limit the sort of ad hoc commentary from the audience, because it's just not possible to have a conversation like that with 200 people. So I hope we can all come to an agreement to do that.
So on the test case for the follow-up on that, just a couple of quick comments. First of all, I'd just like to remark on this sort of assumption that it's an urban thing, that if we all grew up on farms and kind of saw this process happen, that we'd all be perfectly okay with turkeys being slaughtered and pigs dying, and we'd understand that it was okay. And I seriously doubt that that's the case. Most people that I know that grow up on farms have mentioned that when they were children, they found it very painful, and it seemed wrong to them, and it was only through constant chronic conditioning that they learned to get used to it. And there's a movie that I highly recommend called Peaceable Kingdom, which is about some people who worked in animal agriculture who had a change of heart just through being around this. So I just like to remark, I don't see it as an urban thing. I think it's a human thing. We have natural compassion and natural sense of justice, and what's happening to animals is simply wrong. And Patrick, you've been the target a lot here. You seem like a very, very nice guy, I'll say that. However, I find your claims of being part of the solution a little less than convincing when you're not even sure if you anesthetize your pigs before castrating them.
Right. That's well, I mean, there are 11 billion livestock that were consumed in the U.S. last year, 11 billion. So who's next?
Suppose that to raise pigs and give them great lives, it has to make economic sense to do so, and that castrating them is just part of what's necessary to do that. Why is that obviously unacceptable? You're giving it a wonderful life by hypothesis. We're imagining an amazing rancher. But in order to do that, you have to pay some costs. There's some trade-offs you have to make. And suppose that this is the most offensive one when we focus in on it. It's not obvious to me that it makes the whole package deal unacceptable, even from the point of view of the pig. Suppose the pig has a choice. Do I want to live and have this sort of existence or not exist at all? It might say, oh, this sounds pretty great, actually. Protection from predators, too. That's a big deal relative to the life of an average pig in the wild.
Sir, question. Question,
okay,
please.
Hello. I just wanted to ask, like, do you consider that meat is unnecessary? But, okay, you don't have to answer.
Who are you directing to? I have no opinion, so it's these guys.
Oh, you have an opinion.
Oh, you just expressed. Okay, whatever.
By the way, just I'm not supposed to interject my opinions. I'm sorry, sure. I let the self get best of me. I just don't like, to have the panelists are the ones supposed to be dealing with questions. And I just don't like the idea that it just becomes a chanting session for people. I want, like, actual questions to be asked of our panelists.
Okay, I just wanted to let you know, like, my name is Patrick, and I have this company called Heritage Girls. And I have this collection of friends. They run these dungeons where we keep women. We treat them really well.
Is this true?
Yes, seriously. And, well, it's all carpeted, and we let them out every once in a while. And I know rape is unnecessary, as is, unfortunately, meat. But, you know, the pleasure beats it, and we raise our girls humanely. And when they get a bit old and ugly, we kind of have to kill them. And we have breeders who
Okay, here's the thing. We get it. What's the difference between, sex trafficking and raising animals?
My question. I just wanted to say, until the last moment, they are also killed humanely. We actually do lethal injection. We don't even have to castrate. You know, they're women. And
I don't think it's appropriate that you speak of rape, so I take the next question.
Okay, how come?
Next question. I'm not going to dignify.
So, is the pleasure of eating meat more important than an animal's life, just as the pleasure of raping more important than a woman's integrity?
You just said that raping was pleasurable. Please sit.
Please sit. Please sit.
That was not what I said.
You actually just did.
You did. Thank you.
Is justifying rape by pleasure is not the same as justifying meat by pleasure?
Stop. Sit down. Next.
Okay, sir.
Your question is going to be great, no matter what it is.
Well, there's been a lot more discussion of ethics tonight than I anticipated, but I wanted to ask something that's a little bit more specifically about the future. And Isha, I was intrigued by your remark that you sort of imagine this pluralistic future where there's the definition of what meat is changes, and people think about it in conceptually differently. But I kind of wanted to ask you and maybe the others of you also to speculate a little bit about, you know, more specifically what that might look like with regard to meat alternatives. And especially intrigued by both the cultured meat approach that you represent, but also the idea that there are more compelling meat analogs being made by, you know, a lot of startups that some of you may have heard of, like Beyond Meat and so forth. And, you know, these two approaches both seem to have some serious pros and cons. In the case of cultured meat, there are still cost issues. There are scientific issues about how do you get the cells to grow in a certain way and structured components that represent different sorts of tissues. And on the other side, there are issues maybe with regard to flavor or the history of meat analogs and so forth. So I'd be curious to ask, you know, how do you see these two threads interacting and one of them potentially emerging more than the other or both of them alongside each other? What is the future of these products?
I think the presence of meat right now is that it's pretty much something like a monopoly. We only really have one definition of meat, and then that meat only comes from a very small handful of companies. So I think meat in general could benefit from kind of breaking up into meat coming from lots of different sources. And then I think when it comes to the analogs and cultured meat, cultured meat costs so much because we've barely made an attempt at making it. I mean, it's only been a few years. That burger that cost $300,000, that wasn't just the cost of multiplying cells. That, in factored into that cost, was the technician's pay for however many months they were working on it. So it wasn't, the cost will come down, and I think that there's no reason why cultured meat can't be equivalent to meat as we know it, at least under the microscope or in our experience of it. And I think meat analogs are coming a long way too, in that they are way better than they used to be. And perhaps in the future there's some kind of blend where they're kind of, some aspects are cultured, some specific meat flavors or meat specific things that you can't quite get with soy or other plant-based proteins. Perhaps they interact. I'm not sure exactly what the future looks like, but I think the best version of the future is one where there's just a lot of options, because that keeps all the meat companies or the meat producers really competing with each other to make better and better products, rather than kind of creating a monopolistic thing that's like, you know, anti-competitive and bad, really. I hope that answers your question.
Thanks very much.
Hi, my name is Andros Forgax, and I'm a co-founder of a company called Modern Meadow, which is developing cultured animal products like leather and meat. I think this has actually been a terrific panel with a great diversity of perspectives, and I actually have a question for the moderator, if you'd be willing to answer a question. So, Dave, you're a chef and a very experimental one at that. And yet the question you asked Isha about cultured meat and about whether it was anti-food, it seemed to have a little bit of a judgment in it. And I'm wondering, what in your mind is really the difference between a kitchen and a lab? Where if in a kitchen you do essentially chemistry experiments, you transform matter, you heat things up, you mix liquids, and essentially that's exactly what happens in a lab. I mean, how do you distinguish between the two?
So, sure. First of all, my job is just to stir the pot a little bit with these with these folks. For me as a cook, and we've actually had this discussion before, for me as a cook, I'm only interested in products that I think have integrity from the beginning to the end. Now, and that comes in terms of I care kind of where they were made. I care kind of how they were treated along. I'm not talking about welfare, although I'm concerned about that. I mean in terms of plants, how they were grown, where, how they were treated post-harvest, how they're ripe and how they're stored, how they're cut, how they're cooked. Every aspect of that, this is my job, it's what I do for a living. Every aspect of that's very important to me. As a person who my problem with my problem with 3D printed food is very similar, and we had this discussion, is that things generally end up being pablum. And so you can get this kind of a reasonable representation of really crappy food, and that's great, except for it's not great. Like, that's not what I do, and that's not what I care about. So to me, like, if the moral weight actually fell on me that I felt that I shouldn't eat meat anymore, I wouldn't cry about it. I would cook other things that I thought were honest and delicious and pure and real. That's just my life. That's what I do. I'm not against a product that's cultured if that product is so damn delicious that I can't wait to go get another bite.
Mm-hmm. It must be.
Well, what if you got a sample of cells and they came from one of Patrick's Berkshire pigs and you got to culture it in your own, bioreactor in your kitchen?
I mean, pig raising from a gustatory standpoint, right, is partially genetics. It's partially raising, and it's partially the conditions during slaughter, and it's partially the conditions handling afterwards, and then also in cooking and cutting, right? Mm-hmm. So each one of these things has an impact from a gustatory standpoint. So to just say, hey, we can take a cell from a Berkshire pig or a woolly mammoth, for that matter, and culture it into something. I mean, I'd have to say I'd want to eat the woolly mammoth cultured stuff. I mean, I would, or if anyone has access to a Siberian unfrozen woolly mammoth, I will cook that for you.
It tastes a lot like a Komodo dragon.
Come on, do you have to go there? Anyway, my point is that if it tastes really good, I will do it. But to me, a Berkshire isn't a collection of cells. It's a lot more than a collection of cells. Okay. If someone could make a collection of cells that made me want to get more, I would buy it, right. Like now.
Right. Because, I mean, just in the same way that you said, all these aspects of the pig's life, including the cooking and everything, contributes to flavor. I think when it comes to culturing meat, we just have a different set. So even the media that you grow that in and the temperature, it becomes very artisanal, I think, with the growing. Of course, we'll see how that
Sure. I mean, maybe you can make something that like is freaking awesome, and then I will buy it.
Yeah, right.
We're just going to take the folks who are here, and then we'll end. So... sorry that there's not time for more, but I think only the folks who have been waiting here for a while, and we'll try to speed it up so we can end on time.
So while it's been an interesting discussion, a lot of it has upset me and offended me, and forgive me if I don't remember everybody's name. You talked about, if you can make a vegan burger that tastes just as awesome as a cow burger, then hell yeah, you're going to go out and get it, but otherwise, no, screw that. And I just don't really understand why taste should trump, taking someone's life and violence. Like, when would taste ever justify violence? In my mind, that's what I would ask you. And I'll let you all answer after I'm done asking the questions. You talked about the economy and, hey, it's just economical. There has to be a trade-off. But the problem is, it's not a trade-off for you. It's a trade-off for the pig. It's his life or her life. It's his comfort. It's his confinement or her confinement. I just don't understand how that's a fair trade-off for the pig. It's not. And then to you, the idea that it's a turkey's job to be your food. To me, this is just as offensive as saying that it's a woman's job to have children and be in the kitchen, or it's a black person's job to clean my house. Have you heard of speciesism? And how is that different from racism, ageism, classism, heterosexism, sexism? I mean, do you not understand why I would be offended by that statement? A turkey doesn't have a job. His or her job is to live. And also, do you believe there's a humane way to take a life? And also, do you take the lives of your pigs on your own farm, or are they sent out to the same slaughterhouse as the rest of the cows and pigs or whatever you're raising? Because if they are, if you're not slicing their throat yourself, they're going into the same awful slaughterhouse where, you know, pigs are boiled alive, where pigs are hung and bones are broken while they're hung and bled out. So, you know, there's no humanity in that.
All right. Do you want to actually take a crack, or do you feel like you've answered this one?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'll just say that one thing that came in, I mean, the Navajo Churro sheep is the oldest breed of domesticated animal in America, and the Navajo really embraced it. It came from the Spanish, and that animal produced wool for them, and it was lived in the house with them. And when it got too old and sick, they killed it and ate it. So, I mean, there's also something historical about an animal helping a family survive through winter, because come February and March, there was nothing around other than the brisket and that ham that had been kept under salt. So, I mean, that is still a part of things. I mean, Heifer International is one of the largest food nonprofits in the world. They give animals to groups for that as well. I mean, one of our projects, Goat-tober, takes only male goats from dairies that would have been killed at birth and gives them a life. They would have been killed at birth or sent into the commodity system, and we pay the farmers a very fair wage so that they raise that male goat, which has no purpose on a dairy. If you've ever tried to milk a male goat, it's a hard process, laborious, doesn't work. And so we call it Goat-tober, and it's the natural season for goat. And just like fruits and vegetables have seasons, so do animals. And, you know, I don't know, there's a lot behind it other than, you know, the things that you bring up. There's a lot of history, and there's a lot of part having to do with just pure survival.
Also, you misunderstood the point I was trying to make with the burger. Bear in mind, I eat meat. That's a separate subject. But my point with the burger was, so if you look past the fact that I'm a meat eater for a moment, that my point with the burger was that I don't think Brooks's veggie burger is good because it's a good fake burger. I think it's a good food product. And I think the way forward to convert people from eating meat, who are current meat eaters, to vegetarians, is giving them products that are delicious in their own right and not fake meat products. So you misunderstood the point I was trying to make there. Mm-hmm. Or I think you misunderstood the point.
If I could just comment on what Patrick said, I think if we were in a situation where in February we had run out of food and we were going to starve, I would not be opposed to having a pig and killing it. But fortunately, we are no longer in that situation. Right. We don't need to eat meat in order to survive, and that does change the ethics of it.
Okay, but I'm going to let – I want Mark to respond to that, and you also had a question to ask afterwards, so you can interpose yours before the next person.
My question's not on that.
But you want to answer that you were specifically.
I mean, I agree that we don't need to eat animals. So, because a vegan diet is actually healthier.
All right, hold on. Wait, we have people who've been waiting to in line to ask questions. Next question. We have.
First, I'd want to just thank all you guys. It's been a very good panel, so thank you for coming out and spending the evening with us, and it's been an interesting one, to say the least. To try to keep it quick, and I won't even really try to define my question too much because I have a feeling that you guys can pick it up and run with it. I'd like to talk about something that really hasn't been talked about, and that's the idea of, you know, wildlife ethics and the idea that, you know, by reducing the demand for meat, what we're, I think, and hopefully doing is allowing the earth to breathe again. And, you know, what I'm kind of interested in is the beings, the non-humans that exist in that space for their own right, for their own freedom. You know, I know I have different views of that, but I just, you know, I thought maybe that would be hopefully an agreeable way to sort of maybe put the conversation in a slightly different place for a minute.
Yeah, there's been a lot of talk about benefits from biodiversity that we didn't fully understand, that we're starting to understand better. Land seems to suck carbon out of the atmosphere faster, the more biodiversity there is there, other things being equal. So that's a benefit to not having a monoculture or agriculture dominating some plot of land and having something better there instead.
Yeah, well, I'd also agree that I think, you know, when we talk about doing without meat, it doesn't mean, as I said before, we're going to plow up all the land. It does mean that we'll have less pressure on the land, we'll feed ourselves more efficiently, and therefore we will have more space for wildlife.
Yeah, I mean, one third of ice-free land is devoted towards animal agriculture, so if we can cut back on that a little bit, there's potential for rewilding. Of course, I don't know if we'll just create more humans to fill the space. I don't.
A more dramatic way of putting it is that by eating meat, we're killing lots of wildlife by taking their habitat away from them. I agree.
I would like to ask about one of the alternatives to eating meat that is growing nowadays, and is eating insects. And the same way we talk about it, it's not ethical to eat animals, and it's not good for the environment to consume them. What about eating insects? Is it a viable solution? Should we foment that? Or
is it ethical to eat insects?
Yeah, and also for the environment, is it sustainable? It is something that we should promote or not at all?
Assuming there's no bad side effects on the environment from raising insects for food in vast quantities, then I would assume that there's nothing particularly ethically objectionable about it. Because I think, like Peter, I think that in order for something to be objectionable about it, the insects would have to be able to suffer or do worse in some ethically important sense.
Right, but the problem is that we don't know for sure that they don't. I think, you know, I'm agnostic on whether insects suffer, I have to say. I just don't think it's very hard to tell. So there is a question over it in that way. There is some research that suggests it could be much more efficient conversion of plants to protein. I think the Dutch government is doing some research on production of mealworms, which you know, they believe can be an effective way of providing more protein for the world. But, you know, if that were so, I guess that would be a plus sign. And then the question is whether these worms or other insects are capable of suffering.
Numbers-wise, I think crickets are like 1-to-1 feed conversion ratio. It's very efficient production of protein. But I see insects more as like a protein thing than a meat thing. You know, there's cricket flour and stuff like that. I don't see it acting really like meat. So I just don't. I don't know. And there's also the possibilities of allergies, because a lot of people with shellfish allergies could potentially have an insect allergy as well.
I was hoping the panel could address in a little bit greater detail public health impacts, environmental impacts. I know we touched briefly on global warming issues, which I think we've all heard. United Nations, many other environmental groups have identified animal agriculture as single leading cause of global warming. But what about water pollution, other forms of air pollution, deforestation? These are all huge issues that we all as a community have to deal with. And then I guess the second prong in terms of public health consumption, when we have science telling us that heart disease, cancer, stroke, many other diseases that are prime causes of death in Western nations are caused by the consumption of animal products, how do we, even on a smaller scale in terms of production, call these things sustainable or healthful for continued sustainability of humans?
I can say something if you like. I think essentially you're right. There are massive problems of water pollution, particularly in those states that have a lot of agriculture, states like North Carolina and Nebraska and so on. The rivers, you know, and the farmers living there themselves will say, you know, when I was a kid, if they're old enough, I used to be able to swim in that river. Now you can't, and it's basically because of manure runoff from the feedlots and the overflow of the lagoons from the pig factories and so on. So that's a huge problem. On the health issue, I think the clearest evidence is about red meat, and I think there clearly is an association between red meat consumption and cancers of the digestive system, especially the colon and colorectal cancers. And I think that's increasingly being recognized. The research is stronger. So I think that can be an important factor, and if that should become better known, then maybe it will be another factor that turns people away from red meat consumption and processed meats, I should say, as well.
I think on the public health thing, there's kind of two categories. One are the diseases of overconsumption, which are very much lifestyle choice related. And then the other are, which I think are more scary and we have less control over, are the risks of epidemic viruses and foodborne illness. I mean, all contamination, foodborne illness, even if it's E. coli in your spinach, it comes from runoff from animal agriculture. It's not a very safe thing, and that comes from just having so many animals packed close together. It's a really great place for disease to mutate and grow.
Yeah, and then actually, if we're talking about public health issues, we should also talk about antibiotic resistance, yes, because we're losing some of our most valuable antibiotics because they're being routinely fed to animals in factory farms at low levels, which means that it doesn't actually kill off the bacteria. It allows them to develop resistance.
Okay, so my question stems from Patrick's assertion that if the industry shifted towards a heritage model, that it would, benefit society and benefit the industry in general. But what do you envision as problem? What type of problems do you envision when that model tries to be brought to scale? Because I think all of these things are really great and they operate well at this size. But considering this is a nation of billions of people, how would you direct that in the future?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I think price. People should be eating less meat. I mean, that's the big part of the Carnivore's Manifesto, is everyone should be eating less meat. We actually call for grinding up most of the animals, as ground meat. I mean, the Italians really teach us, an ounce of meat on a pasta is very filling, and one cow could feed thousands of people. We disagree actually with 38 ounce ribeye steaks and this and that. So it's a price game, and we've been accused of being elitist because we charge $140 for a turkey. And my response back is, how dare you tell a poor person that they should eat an unhealthy product? They should also be. You don't have the double reasoning for someone because of how rich or poor they are. Everyone should be aspiring to eat the best. And you don't tell someone to eat the worst because they're poor. Better not eat meat at all, or just keep it for special occasions. But, going up on price, eating less meat, eating better meat. And, the current system doesn't feed the world anyway. So it's a lot to ask for heritage ideas to feed the world too. But, I believe it can be done, and, people should be eating less but eating better quality.
Okay, so please fill out your surveys. Thank you so much for our super esteemed panel coming. And to the woman with the poster with grommets, I'm sorry I got heated.
They all
left. Thank you so much for coming.
Heritage Radio Network is a member-supported nonprofit organization broadcasting over 30 live shows a week. To learn more and donate, visit our website or connect with us on iTunes, Stitcher, Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram for more. Thanks for listening.